So picture this. It's 1940, right? The Dutch city of Eindhoven is just, well, it's basically suffocating under German occupation.
Oh, yeah, the tension is just palpable everywhere you go.
Exactly. And what does this 4-year-old girl, Narissa Greenfield, decide to do? She marches right up to an electrical outlet in her bedroom wall, presses her face to it, and just screams, "Rottenkrauts!" with the full force of her tiny lungs.
Which is just, I mean, as a parent, that is a scenario that would make your blood run entirely cold.
Oh, absolutely. She does it because in her 4-year-old brain, she is totally convinced that the outlet is like a hollow tube leading directly into the house next door.
Right, and the house next door is where high-ranking German officers are currently billeted.
Yeah. So insulting German officers, even as a child, wasn't just some, some minor faux pas in occupied Holland.
No, not at all. Depending on who overheard it, I mean, that could invite a Gestapo visit, an interrogation, or frankly, much worse. The entire family's safety was theoretically hanging on the acoustic properties of a 1940s electrical socket.
And her mother's reaction is what really sets the tone for everything we are going to unpack in today's deep dive. Because she doesn't panic.
She doesn't.
No. She just gives a small smile, gently tells Narissa to hush, and just moves on. So for you listening, today we are exploring excerpts from a book called Undermining Emile, A Perilous Pursuit by the Dutch-Australian author Narissa Greenfield.
We've got a really massive stack of sources here. Memoirs, historical research, intelligence records, all sorts of things.
Yeah, and the mission today is to look at the realities of the Second World War, but through two completely radically different lenses at the exact same time.
Right, because we are simultaneously examining the micro-level perspective of this completely oblivious 4-year-old girl.
Screaming into the wall.
Exactly. And then the macro level top secret intelligence war, where high-ranking members of the German military were actually actively plotting to take down Hitler from the inside.
It is a phenomenal juxtaposition. And really, for you listening right now, whether you've read like dozens of books on this era or literally none at all, this deep dive is about the hidden mechanics of history.
It's about realizing that those grand sweeping narratives we get in history books, they're actually built out of millions of strange, hyperlocal, and often deeply misunderstood personal experiences.
Right, because when you look at Narissa's childhood, the adults around her were basically running a full-time psychological operation just to keep her in the dark.
Oh, for sure. They constructed an entirely alternate reality for her. Because when you look at the mechanics of living under occupation, physical survival is, well, it's really only half the battle.
What's the other half?
The other half is psychological survival. Narissa's parents were constantly evaluating the world around them and filtering out the sheer terror before it could even reach her.
And the examples she gives in the book are wild when you know the context. Like, she remembers sitting on her front steps, watching German soldiers march past her house in perfect formation.
Oh.
Yeah, and she can hear their iron-studded boots hitting the cobblestones. And they're belting out this booming, aggressive sailor song from the First World War. Denn wir fahren gegen England.
Which translates to, "For we are sailing against England."
Exactly. But the detail that catches her 4-year-old eye isn't the weapons or the song, is that they have twigs and leaves stuffed into their helmets.
Kids always notice the strangest things. So she naturally asks her father, why do they have leaves in their helmets? And notice what he doesn't do here.
Right, he doesn't tell her the terrifying truth.
No, he doesn't explain the mechanics of sniper fire or the constant threat of aerial bombardment or that these men are actively trying to avoid being killed by resistance fighters.
He just gives a one-word answer. He says, "Camouflage."
It's brilliant in its simplicity.
It really is. It completely satisfies her curiosity without introducing any concept of death. She just says, "Oh," and gets right back to playing.
But that filtering, that gets much harder to maintain as the war escalates.
Oh, definitely. Because later on, Eindhoven becomes an actual target. She describes hearing the air raid sirens for the first time.
That sliding glissando wail.
Yes, that terrifying sliding wail that meant bombers were approaching. And the sound itself is physically distressing to a kid, so she starts crying.
And here you see the real-time calculation of a parent under just immense pressure. Her father pulls her in and tells her, "They're just factory whistles. The factories are just practicing."
Wow.
He is taking a sound that universally signals imminent destruction, and just he maps it onto something completely mundane and industrial.
And the physical culmination of all these lies, it happens much later, during a massive bombing raid in September 1944. And Tragically, this raid actually happens the day after Eindhoven was officially liberated.
Which is just heartbreaking.
It is. The Luftwaffe comes back, they drop these blinding yellow flares that light up the night sky, and the bombs start falling. The family runs down into their tiny cellar, and her mother starts handing out aluminum cooking pots.
Wait, cooking pot?
Yes. She tells them to wear the cooking pots on their heads, like helmets.
Oh my goodness.
Which, Narissa notes, you know, looking back as an adult is utterly absurd. If a bomb had hit their house, those aluminum pots wouldn't have done a single thing against three stories of brick and timber collapsing on top of them.
No, of course not.
But she remembers that putting the pot on her head made her feel safe. It actually stopped her teeth from chattering. It acted like a, well, like a mental shock absorber.
A mental shock absorber. That is actually the perfect way to look at it, because in the immediate crisis of sitting in a dark cellar while explosives literally fall from the sky, understanding the physical truth of your vulnerability does not increase your chances of survival.
Right. Panic is what kills you.
Exactly. Panic can be deadly. The illusion of safety, the cooking pot, prevents that panic. So in a very real way, that lie is a critical survival tool.
It makes you question the inherent value we place on the truth, you know? Like, is it always better to be fully aware of the terrifying reality of your situation?
That's a deep question.
Because while her parents were maintaining this sort of micro-illusion of safety in their cellar, the physical survival of the entire town of Eindhoven relied on a massive, highly complex macro illusion happening at the town's biggest employer.
Right, the Philips Electrical Factory. I mean, Eindhoven was essentially a company town built entirely around Philips.
And Narissa's father happened to be a chief electrotechnical engineer there.
Yeah, and when the German army invaded in 1940, the top management of Philips basically fled to Allied territory. But Fritz Philips, the son of the founder, he made this huge decision to stay behind.
So he is left holding the bag, basically trying to manage thousands of employees under the watchful eye of an occupying army.
And to understand the absolute tightrope Fritz Philips was walking, we have to look at the conflicting strategies within the German leadership itself.
Right, because they weren't unified on this.
No, not at all. Hermann Göring essentially viewed conquered territories as a buffet. He wanted to strip the Netherlands of all its raw materials, completely dismantle the factories, and just ship everything back to Germany.
Which would have meant mass unemployment and eventual starvation for the people of Eindhoven.
Precisely. But Arthur Seyssinquart, who was the Hitler-appointed head of state in the Netherlands, he had a totally different strategy. He wanted to integrate the Dutch economy into the Reich smoothly.
Okay, so how does Fritz navigate that?
Well, to keep Göring's looters away, Fritz Philips struck a deal directly with Seyssinquart. He agreed to keep the factory running and supply the German military.
Okay, wait, I have to push back here. Because hearing that, calling him a collaborator feels, well, it feels entirely too simple, maybe even a bit harsh.
It is complicated.
Very.
Right.
When you look at the day-to-day reality, he was keeping the town alive. When food shortages became severe, Philips used company resources to set up soup kitchens, serving something called Philiprak.
Yes, Philiprak.
Yeah, which was this really heavy stew of mashed potatoes and vegetables, and he did it just to keep his workers and their families from starving to death.
It forces us to confront this really severe ethical gray area, because on one hand, yes, he's feeding the town, but on the other, he is actively participating in the enemy's war machine.
Right.
Under his watch, the factory produced roughly a third of the vacuum tubes used in German military radios. And the economic mechanics of this are just astounding. The Germans didn't even pay for these supplies with their own money.
Wait, really? How did they pay?
They paid Philips using funds effectively stolen from the Dutch government and local banks. So Fritz Philips is fueling the Nazi communications network, and it's being paid for by stolen Dutch money.
Man, that is bleak. But the town survives, and there's actually a statue of Fritz Philips in Eindhoven today.
Oh, is there?
Yeah. And what I find so compelling about that monument is the design. It's not elevated on some massive imposing pedestal. The bronze figure of Fritz is placed right at street level, standing shoulder to shoulder with the pedestrians.
Oh, I love that.
Right. It physically represents that murky, grounded complexity. He was in the mud with them.
And that complexity deepens even more when you look at what was happening on the factory floor itself. While Fritz was managing the Germans from the boardroom, his engineers were actually running a covert economic resistance right under the noses of the occupying forces.
And Narissa's father was deeply involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
After a British bombing raid damaged the main plant, his electrotechnical department was relocated to a cigar factory.
Right, and they were supposedly building equipment for the Germans there.
Supposedly, yeah. But they established this brilliant system. They had a doorman keeping watch. When the German quality control inspectors would finish their rounds and leave the building, the doorman would signal the floor.
And the moment the Germans were gone, the engineers would swap out the official components and just start building miniature radio receivers for the Dutch resistance.
And the mechanics of how they hid these radios, it's just incredible. They didn't just toss them in boxes. They took hardcover books, painstakingly hollowed out the center pages, and nested the receivers inside.
That is so clever.
Right? They even repurposed empty baby powder containers, fitting the electronics into the exact dimensions of the tin so they could be smuggled out undetected.
The logistics required to pull that off in a heavily monitored facility, I mean, it's staggering. You have to siphon off raw materials, manufacture the components without throwing off the official production quotas, and then physically move contraband past German checkpoints.
And those baby powder radios were absolute lifelines. The Nazis had instituted a total news blackout. Those hidden receivers allowed the Dutch resistance to bypass the propaganda and tune into exile broadcasts from Queen Wilhelmina in London.
They were pulling the truth literally out of the air from hundreds of miles away,
Exactly.
which, you know, presents this really profound paradox in Nerissa's story.
How so?
Well, the people of Eindhoven were risking their lives to hear the truth from London, while simultaneously these horrific truths were unfolding right in their own neighborhoods that went completely unacknowledged.
Yeah, hearing her talk about her childhood memories alongside the actual historical facts, it's like finding a fond, nostalgic photograph from your past. The lighting is warm, you're playing with your friends, everything looks perfectly innocent.
Right.
But then, years later, you zoom in on the background of the image and you realize there's a literal monster standing in the shadows that you never even noticed.
And Nerissa only recognized those monsters decades later. As a child, she would overhear the adults whispering certain heavy, loaded words. She heard the word razzia, which meant a sudden, coordinated SS raid.
Terrifying.
Yeah, and she heard the word "foot," Dutch for wrong, which was the label given to local citizens who collaborated and just could not be trusted.
She didn't grasp the gravity of those words then, but the monster was totally in the frame. There's a story she tells about the summer of 1943. She's 7 years old. About 40 caravans belonging to the Sinti and Roma people arrive on a plot of land near a local canal. So Nerissa and her friends walk down there on a sunny afternoon. They stare at the caravans, they skip stones in the canal, they don't say a word, and then they just go home. To her, it was just a quiet afternoon curiosity.
But the reality behind that quiet afternoon is just devastating. Those caravans weren't there by choice.
No.
The German authorities had deliberately forced the Roma and Sinti populations out of scattered rural locations and corralled them into centralized holding areas just outside municipalities like Eindhoven.
They were grouping them together to make them easy targets. Because in 1944, the Germans executed a massive razzia. They arrested 578 Roma and Sinti people in a single sweep.
Wow.
42 of them were taken from Eindhoven. And of those 42, only three survived the camps.
Think about the psychological weight of that realization for the author. I mean, the very people she casually watched while skipping stones were actively being staged for eradication.
And the horrors were even closer to home than the canal.
Yeah.
She writes about discovering the Stolperstein, the stumbling stones.
Right, those small 10-centimeter brass plaques embedded in the cobblestone pavements all over Europe today.
Yeah. They're placed outside the last known voluntary residences of Holocaust victims. And decades later, Nerissa realizes that the father of her daily childhood playmates worked for a Jewish swimwear factory owner named Jacques Deher.
And Deher was murdered in 1943. His entire family was sent to Sobibor and Auschwitz.
And her playmates, the kids she literally ran around the neighborhood with, they had absolutely no idea. Their parents absorbed that trauma and just hid it. The disappearances were engineered to be quiet. They were methodical.
And sadly, even inside the Phillips factory, where the engineers were so bravely building the secret radios, there was a dark, methodical clearing out happening.
Yeah, this part is tough.
The German authorities ordered all Jewish employees at Phillips to be separated into what they called a special department. They were eventually rounded up and deported to a concentration camp in Veit.
Right, this is known as the Phillips deportation. And the way the Germans extracted labor from these people is sickening. They were forced to manufacture something called pinch cats.
Wait, pinch cats? What are those?
A pinch cat is a battery-free flashlight. It relies on a hand-squeezed dynamo to generate light. The German military really needed them, so they used the captive Jewish employees at Voot as slave labor to build them.
That's awful.
But to guarantee that the men met production quotas and didn't revolt, the SS employed a remarkably cruel psychological tactic against their families.
They weaponized hope.
They really did. Tell us about Elisabeth Horniman, because her story is just, it's shattering.
Yeah, Elisabeth Horniman was the wife of one of the deported Phillips workers. She lived just 2 minutes away from Narissa's primary school. The SS contacted wives like Elisabeth and basically promised them that if they voluntarily joined their husbands inside the Voot concentration camp, their families would be kept together and guaranteed safety.
So you have a mother terrified, living under occupation, trying to protect her children. She has her two young sons, Edward and Alexander, hidden away on local farms.
Right.
And out of deep love and a desperate belief in this promise of safety, she pulls her boys out of hiding. She walks them directly into the concentration camp.
And the promise was a complete fabrication. In June 1944, as the war was turning against Germany, the camp authorities put Elisabeth, her husband, and her two young boys on a train to Auschwitz. None of the Horniman family survived.
So we have this quiet, bureaucratic, entirely invisible horror happening just out of frame. But what is so striking about this deep dive is how that invisible horror violently contrasts with what happens when the war actually ends for Eindhoven.
Oh, the liberation.
Yes. Because we often picture liberation as this pristine moment, right? Flags waving, cheering, kissing in the streets. But the reality Narissa experienced was a loud, chaotic, and highly visible mess.
Well, the German retreat from Eindhoven was the exact opposite of their arrival. There was no marching in perfect formation singing sailor songs.
No twigs in the helmets.
Nope. It was undignified panic. The soldiers were fleeing north on stolen bicycles, horse carts, basically anything with wheels they could commandeer.
And Narissa, who has been shielded by her parents' shock absorbers for 4 years at this point, is completely oblivious to the volatility of an armed, humiliated, retreating army.
She has no idea of the danger.
None. She is standing on the pavement watching them flee. She spots this wobbly, older German soldier walking strangely. So what does she do? She steps right up behind him and starts mimicking his walk, just openly mocking him in the middle of the street.
A terrified neighbor actually has to sprint out of their house, grab her by the arm, and physically drag her indoors before the soldier turns around.
It's the ultimate example of a child misinterpreting danger. But the danger in Eindhoven didn't just evaporate because the German uniforms left. The immediate aftermath of liberation acted like a pressure valve, releasing years of bottled-up resentment among the local Dutch population.
Yeah, we see the brutal, really ugly side of liberation here. The locals immediately began hunting down the Voot citizens, you know, the ones who were wrong, the local collaborators.
And their primary targets were often women who had romantic or physical relationships with German soldiers. Mobs would drag these women out of their homes, throw them onto wooden carts, parade them through the streets, and publicly shave their heads bald.
It is a visceral, deeply misogynistic form of public shaming. It was designed to strip these women of their dignity and mark them permanently as traitors to the community.
So Narissa is walking through her neighborhood shortly after liberation, and a woman steps out of a doorway with a completely bald head. Narissa had never seen a bald woman before. The visual was so shocking to her that she screamed in terror and ran all the way home.
And once again, what do her parents do?
They deploy the mental shock absorbers.
Exactly. They tell her, oh, that poor woman, she must have been very sick and her hair fell out.
That moment brings the central thesis of Narissa Greenfield's work into perfect focus. It bridges the hyperlocal chaos of Eindhoven to the massive macro-level history of the war.
Right, because while the citizens of Eindhoven were shaving the heads of local women for low-level collaboration, the absolute highest level of Voot behavior, well, at least from Adolf Hitler's perspective, was happening at the very top of his own military intelligence network.
This is the core of undermining Emil. High-ranking German military officers, specifically Wilhelm Canaris and Hans Oster, were secretly orchestrating the ultimate betrayal of the Nazi regime from the inside.
Canaris and Oster were the heads of the Abwehr, which was the German military intelligence agency. They gave Hitler the secret code name Emil.
Ah, hence the book title.
Exactly. And their position gave them unprecedented power to undermine him. Because they controlled the flow of information, they could manipulate it. They actively leaked upcoming invasion plans to the Allies. They issued fake passports to Jewish citizens, officially declaring them vital intelligence assets just to get them out of the country safely.
The logistics of running a resistance ring from inside the Gestapo's backyard is just mind-bending. And the risk was absolute. They weren't just risking a firing squad. they were defying the sip and half tongue law.
The sick and half tongue was a kin liability law. If Canaris or Auster were caught committing treason, the state would not just execute them. The state would legally hunt down their wives, their children, and their extended families and send all of them to concentration camps.
The moral courage it takes to operate the machinery of a regime while actively trying to destroy it, knowing your family's lives are on the line. I mean, it's staggering.
It really is.
And think about the visual irony here. That same green German uniform that made the wobbly soldier an enemy to little Nerissa on the streets of Eindhoven, that exact same uniform was being worn by Canaris and Auster. They were using the uniform of the oppressor as a camouflage to save lives and tear down Hitler's empire.
It completely shatters the idea that history can be neatly divided into black and white, good and evil. The truth is incredibly muddy. Motives are hidden behind uniforms, behind the locked doors of an electrical factory, and behind the lies parents tell their children.
So as we pull all these threads together, what is the ultimate takeaway from Nerissa Greenfield's deep dive into her past? It proves that history is never just a top-down timeline of treaties and battles.
No, it's a wildly complicated web.
It's built out of fiercely protective parents pretending air raid sirens are just factory whistles. It's built out of brilliant engineers spending hours hollowing out hardcover books to hide radio coils in baby powder tins.
And it's the unseen, agonizing tragedy of a family two doors down voluntarily walking onto a train to Auschwitz.
Right. And it's high-ranking spies wearing the swastika to do the work of the righteous.
This is exactly why memoirs and oral histories are so vital to our understanding of the world. They fill in the massive psychological gaps that traditional textbooks just ignore. A textbook tells you the dates a city was occupied and liberated. A memoir tells you how the human mind actually survives the occupation. It shows us the precise mechanics of resilience.
And that leaves you with something pretty heavy to think about today. Because we've spent all this time looking at how a four-year-old's entire perception of a global war was shaped by the stories the adults around her chose to tell her.
Right, the shock absorbers.
When you tell a child an air raid siren is a factory whistle, the world feels safe. The aluminum cooking pot feels like armor. But turn that lens on yourself for a moment. Think about your own understanding of the complex, chaotic global events happening right now.
That's a great point.
How much of your reality is being shaped by the protective aluminum pots placed over your head by modern media, by the algorithms filtering your news feed, or by the authorities you inherently trust? What realities are unfolding right next door, just out of frame, that you won't fully realize until years later when you finally zoom in on the background of the picture?
The monsters rarely announce themselves. Usually, they are just standing quietly in the background, disguised as the everyday.
So take off the cooking pot, take a hard look at the background, and keep asking questions.